Your Holiness, this morning we will be focusing a little bit more on concepts and on the relationship between perception and concepts, mood and perception, and the way top-down and bottom-up processing interact. And we'll be looking at that both from the standpoint of contemporary neuroscience and from the standpoint of Buddhist epistemology. And I was wondering if before we begin with Professor Catherine Kerr's presentation, Professor Kerr's in neuroscience at Brown University, whether you had any reflections on yesterday's discussion or any reflections on the topic for this morning before we begin.
Okay.
Then I'll ask Catherine to begin her discussion.
Great. Well, let's see what we can do now. And we're going to talk about the perception of body sensations. And I'm really excited to share this with you because I've been very inspired by your writing on the importance of compassion in science and in medicine. So thank you for that. And thank you to the Sarah Monastery and to Richie and everyone at Mind and Life. So I guess, is my sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sabas question. The style. Style yagadis. Style yagadis.
Thank you. Okay, she'll be talking in the afternoon. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you today about feeling your own body sensations. And basically, I'm going to build on a lot that Pavan talked about yesterday. But I'm going to, body sensations are a little bit different than the visual sensations that he talked about. So they're subjective. You know, a feeling in our belly is very difficult for scientists to measure that. They're related.
So, morangati the wangshi
And they're related to emotions. So you can get a strong feeling in your heart center, and that's both a sensation and an emotion. And that's really different from visual stimuli. And they're also related to our feeling of our own body in space. So right now, you might feel your entire body, your head, and your buttocks. And as you feel that, that feeling is very important as you think about planning to move. You really need to know where your body is. All of that makes body sensations different from visual sensations. So, but the key takeaway is that the mind plays a critical role in shaping.
When you mention body, including brain.
Including the...
When you talk about body sensations, to correlate to the Buddhist kind of epistemological thinking... It's one of the sensory modalities. So when you talk about body sensations, are you also including in it the role brain plays in it?
Yes, I am including the role the brain plays.
Be careful. His Holiness is really asking whether you're talking about sensations of things happening in your brain, or are you talking about the use of the brain to monitor the rest of the body?
I'm talking about both.
Both, okay.
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
So,
it's very loud, but anyway.
Can you turn down a little bit? Thoranichi kar do.
What's that? Yeah. No, I'm going to. I'll get to that. So, I'm going to talk about two sets of processes. One is the perception, a very fast perception of body sensations. And you talked yesterday with Pavan about very fast perception. It's the same process, just feeling your own body, very, very fast.
I'll explain to you later. It's not about the brain.
So when you, for example, come into accidentally contact something, there's a body perception, but the brain is not playing a role in paying attention.
Yes.
It's a very instantaneous experience. No.
So actually, if you go like this, like that, I go like this. In 1/50th of a second. So yeah, if you, I could do it on your finger.
I do. Is it that? Yeah, but on the way, like that.
So when you're trying to.
Immediately felt. But that's mentally, because of that, no motivation.
So, you know, for example, your intention may be to pick up the glass, but on the way you bump into something. So there is already a contact which happened unintentionally.
Right.
You feel it.
So you experience it.
But the mental level, because of that, case.
So you might pick it up, you register and become aware, but sometimes you even may not notice that you had some other contact before the intended...
There's a mechanism for in your brain that decides whether you should notice that sensation or not. And it depends on whether it's important to notice. That's sort of part of the mechanism. But let me just show you the pathway, Your Holiness... which is when you touch something, it basically travels, the electrical signal travels from the finger to the brain in 1/50th of a second. That's how fast it is. And it arrives in the cerebral cortex at the top of the brain in 1/50th of a second. So... Oh, should I keep going? Okay, sorry. So I want to just tell you about the way that the brain is organized to detect that touch. So when you go like this, and you knock your elbow, that sensation is processed in a special area in the brain. And the area in the brain is called the primary somatosensory cortex. Yes, so the primary somatosensory cortex, I don't know if you've seen this map before. It's the brain's map of the body. And it actually is a strip that is right here in the middle of the skull. And it goes like this. And what happens, for example, if your finger is touched. Okay, if your finger is touched.
This is the body map you're talking about.
Yes, this is called a body map.
Risha.
And when my finger is touched, that particular area in the brain called the finger map is activated, and it's very specific just for this finger. And each part of the body has its own area that is dedicated to representing a part of the body. So it's a very beautiful form of organization. Everything is very highly specific as it goes up into the brain. So the reason that I'm mentioning this to you is that there was an experiment that we did that showed us what happens when you pay attention to your finger. Things actually change in the primary somatosensory cortex.
Say that again.
When you pay attention to your finger, so if you pay attention to your index finger, you actually are driving change in the primary somatosensory cortex, not even being touched.
So you mean to just focus your attention on the finger changes the way the sensations are processed?
It changes the way the sensations are processed.
Thank you.
Yes.
The catch is on it.
So, and there's actually a very beautiful mechanism in the brain that helps to do this. And the mechanism is situated in a structure called the thalamus, which sits right beneath the cerebral cortex. And so that's the thalamus right there. And it's called the gatekeeper of the cortex. And what it does is it actually shuts out irrelevant information. And what's interesting about this is that roughly 85% of the inputs to your system are blocked from entering the cerebral cortex because they aren't important. So right now, you would be flooded with sensation if it weren't for the thalamus. There would be too much sensation. There would be too many sounds, too many sights, and too many body feelings. And so the thalamus is a video editor, and it actually sort of deletes many of these inputs from consciousness.
Yes.
It's near there.
It's below the cortex, and it's sharing information.
Cortex the content. Chikapshara di water yores. The amygdala di water. Then moran nega dirisha. Then the thalamus the one shake. The nga ke tone. You damater ribe. The bangpush push lingurwa. Tebe. Di ye the tangzin chene. Kaatum cheche. Kaje kajul hatsi. Chamba le chugu yomares. So thalamus gate keeps not just sensations coming out of the body, but also like auditory signals and
visual signals.
Visual signals.
Yes. But it's very important for allowing us to focus on the sensations that matter. So, for instance, right now, your thalamus is favoring the auditory stream because you're listening to my voice. And a stream that is not on probably is the sensations in the buttocks. That's gated. So it's the thalamus is basically dynamically shutting off irrelevant inputs and helping you focus on relevant inputs just in real time.
The
And one way of thinking about the importance of this editing mechanism is that people who have...
So, just as you showed the body map,
yes,
in the cortex, aren't there specific centers for the different senses?
Yes, there are
different areas,
seeing, hearing, smelling, like that.
Yes.
Yes, and
So what is that other green area?
The way that it works is the thalamus is helping to regulate the primary somatosensory cortex. So that's the map that I just showed you that goes like this, the body map in the cortex. It's actually strongly regulated by the thalamus and by interactions between the thalamus and primary somatosensory cortex.
So he's only asking this question, so what does the SI stand for?
So SI is just an abbreviation for primary somatosensory cortex.
Primary.
I apologize, I should have written that out.
Yeah. Primary sensory cortex, Michelle.
Somatosensory. So anything, you know, that involves touch in the body, that's primary somatosensory cortex. So this video editor actually... And what's interesting and a little bit generalizable about what I've presented to you is that the thalamus also gates auditory sensations and visual sensations. So it's a sort of a little decision maker that sits below the cortex that helps decide what sensory stimuli should reach consciousness. And what's really interesting about this is that the mind, and especially sensory attention, exerts very strong control over these video editing settings. The mind controls the sensory attention, mental attention, controls the thalamus's regulation of those sensory inputs, which I think is.
And the resistance in it, turned up this in terms of the bottom up distinction. Come, how you do that?
So in Buddhist certain types, some texts, there's a conceptualization of the fine-tuning of the body sensations, and particularly in relation to, for example, sexual experience, there is understanding that...
So actually, you see, through meditation, or you see touch, or physical, certain sort of, or say the... we call energy or some form of, I think, liquid. It's come not necessarily through central channel, but some connection with the central channel. So there is it called inner texture.
There's a sort of a term that is used is inner texture.
Yes.
Inner experience of texture, which then acts as the actual experience.
So that brings some kind of physical pleasure.
Bliss. It's an experience of bliss.
Oh.
You see, that, Kasurda, effect mental level, or say a certain kind of peace. Or that also, you see, ticker to reduce grosser level of consciousness.
The bliss or the sensation that
It's a bit more granular. His Holiness was, the main point His Holiness is asking is that in this conception, there is this idea of inner texture.
Yes.
Which then acts as the, you know, kind of condition trigger for the experience of bliss, which then affects the mind by calming it down of conceptualization.
Can I ask about inner texture?
So that's what His Holiness is asking, whether, you know, scientists would make sense or what
yes,
something like that
I
could
think
be.
That that's actually a so, related...
So I'm wondering, you see, that inner touch
therein.
Also is related with this part or not? That's,
His Holiness is wondering whether there could be some kind of representation of that, what we call the inner texture
yes.
in the brain. In the brain.
Well,
same area or different area.
So I think what the way it would work is this area would merge with a number of different areas, and that would produce an overall inner texture. So this is actually a very specific and highly pointed attentional, focused attentional spotlight. It doesn't tend to get broad texture. Broad texture emerges when multiple maps that do different functions integrate together to produce our sense of our inner texture. So... I'm just... So I'm just going to tell you about an experiment that we did that might be interesting, which was using something called magnetoencephalography. And basically we used these really amazing super quantum interference devices that are usually pointed at distant stars. And we actually pointed them towards the brain to detect the brain's magnetic fields. And what we found was that people were able to control the neurons in the finger map. They were able to turn the volume up or turn the volume down very precisely just by paying attention to the finger.
So are these just ordinary subjects?
Sorry?
Are these ordinary subjects?
Yes, these are ordinary people. Yeah. And just by paying attention to your finger, you can control the volume of this thalamus mechanism, and then you can actually get better, you can better detect a touch.
It's common with animal.
Sensory experiences. Sensory experiences are common with animals.
They're common in...
With animals.
Yes.
Animals also have sensory experiences.
Yes, exactly. But animals cannot control the attentional spotlight.
Because of the mind. They're not applied to,
they don't
they're not
have
able
the ability.
To apply the mind. Yeah.
They don't have the ability to have that strong focus on the finger that is voluntary.
I think animal.
I mean, if you use food or something, you can train them to do that, but it's a little different.
You see, through smell, they know this is my longtime friend. So the mental level.
So there is some role of mind playing there.
Yes.
Because the recognition works.
Yes, there is. But the strength of the ability to pay attention to your body and use the mind to focus on the body is a very human trait. And so we actually studied this in people who, I'm sorry that I want to make sure that we get to things, but we actually studied this in people who did mindfulness training, who did Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness training program. And...
Jon Kabat-Zinn said,
As many people are familiar, the mind training program from Jon Kabat-Zinn involves very strong control over the attentional spotlight focused on the body and the breath. So there's 8 weeks of very direct training on having the brain focus on sensations. And what we found was that...
His Holiness has, Kathy, is that, you know, we're not talking about any religious practice, we're talking about just ordinary people's experience. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you're completely focused on a particular task, then at that point, although there might be people walking around you, there's something, some noise in the background, you don't register them. You're completely focused.
Yes.
As if you don't hear or you don't see. So in the Buddhist or Indian epistemological thinking, we call these inattentive perceptions. Huh. So in those kind of situations, what is the thalamus doing?
The thalamus is actually facilitating that attentional focus and is blocking out other sensations.
The thalamus ki kaagi oris. Wangshie ki.
So there's a very famous situation.
Some kind of phenomenal appearance, but you don't notice anything.
Oh, you're not concentrating?
No, you're not concentrating.
No, he's talking about...
I thought you were concentrating.
You're concentrating on a particular task.
Okay. Yeah.
So then the other things that are happening in the periphery...
Animals show that as well.
So no, animals do have this thalamic mechanism.
I think maybe a dog give without food, I think a half day or something. Then become very hungry and give food. That moment, I think sound may not
disturb.
Or disturb.
Right. Yes, and that...
So it's the same
phenomenon. It would be the same. It would be the same mechanism.
Yeah.
The main difference is that we have much more control over the mechanism. And what we found when people took 8 weeks of mindfulness and really trained the attentional spotlight was they had better control over the thalamus cortex loop. So, these studies illustrate in an important way how the mind shapes the perception of body sensations. That the sensory attention plays a very strong role in perception of body sensations. There's another aspect of this, which is emotions play a very strong role in the perception of body sensations. So you have people who are have a lot of pain in their bellies, and then they become afraid of the pain. They think it means that they're sick. And what happens is that actually amplifies the sensation. And there's a lot of processing between the brain and especially an area called the insula and the sensations in the trunk, the belly, the heart center, the throat. All of these areas are, the sensations are received in the insula and at that location and actually in the body, they're sort of mixed with emotions. Because in some respect, some of our emotions we actually experience as body sensations. So emotions can have a very strong impact on the perception of body sensations. And Richie referred to this yesterday as the process called interoception. That's this process of really feeling all of your viscera and taking those processes in. And what's exciting about interoception is that we have people have done many studies now, or several studies, with looking at contemplative practice. And it looks like various contemplative practices have a strong impact on this interoception. And they can change it from being highly negative. Because some people, everything they feel in their body is very negative. Their sensations are very negative.
Interoceptions labde gonda susu lushie nalo ya cho yongurwa cho tin zulia lebe tone gonda tatan chores te mika shelia ji ngema na to dukta sin na de ge tone kengen tebin kangen tebin za jema na su tan jong nga ta shu ji nyanga chim na me ro sam sing ang ra che nga ra de kyen gi su bu na su khona shuk chur ta ya shu gen te ge ores te tin zur ri le ya ane te ma nya sha la so bu gom gu lo jang ba ina di ta ne kho ma le ma ja ya tin de ge shu gen te bu du s so how would you describe is you know when you talk about how emotions affect that you know the degree if I can use that word of experience of that sensation say a negative sensation so to what extent we can say it is actually increasing the physical sensation or if one can distinguish you know at the level of the physical sensation there may not be a real increase but it's the added component of the mind
the one thing that,
that makes it more complicated
so
I mean, can one make such distinctions at all
or
is it all lumped together
like belly pain there is a little bit of a difference down there is something happening in the belly but a lot of the negative processing happens in the early sensory part of the brain. Right when the sensation arrives in the brain, it gets filtered in a negative way. People have, the emotions cause people to actually process these body sensations negatively and to have a negative prediction of what they mean. People experience their, say, belly pain, and for some people, that belly pain comes to mean that maybe they might be very, very sick when they're not. So there's this interpretation that's happening.
No, I think the question was more specific.
Yes.
Do you want to?
Well, if I can just chime in for 1 second. With respect to pain, we know that there are certain areas of the brain that represent the physical sensations of the pain and other areas which represent the emotional distress. And it's possible to have the physical sensations amplified at the same time that the emotional components are decreased. And we see, for example, in long-term meditation practitioners, metula, the amplitude of the physical sensation is actually enhanced, but the amplitude of the emotional components are decreased. So the sensations are vivid, but there's no distress or very little distress.
So that suffering is decreased. One way to think of it. Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you.
this question is that the point His Holiness is making is that, of course, the mind plays a role in our response to the experience of suffering or pain. And so when you have a mental role that is playing differently, negatively versus someone who's more kind of, you know, measured, would one see actual difference in the degree of the physical sensation, or is it more
See a difference in the way that the signal is processed in primary somatosensory cortex, for sure. And you also see a difference in the way that it travels from the, say, the hand to the brain. What happens is there some people actually take what would be a benign and comfortable sensation. Their system converts it to a painful sensation. And that's when their systems are just overloaded with pain. And that's something that can happen for people who have chronic pain.
So let me finish the translation. So His Holiness was saying that we know from our own everyday experience of people that we know that people react differently to tragedy and adversity. You know, some people may have a small illness, but they make it a huge deal, and then they kind of get depressed, and they can't get out of it. Then there are others who may be even suffering, you know, have greater illnesses, but they are able to. They are more resilient. They're more measured. They see this in proper proportion, and so although the actual real experience of pain may be kind of the physical may be the same. But how we react tend to make a big difference.
Richie's study actually showed that people can learn how to not be distressed by their own pain. And advanced meditators actually show this very strongly, that some of the pain signal is the same, but the emotional experience of the pain is transformed.
So the Holiness's question is, in the case of people who negatively relate to a painful experience, are the pain signals themselves
so
heightened?
The answer that's really the
question.
Also make differences?
Yes.
I think the same. Otherwise...
There's your signal. So you would say it makes a difference.
Yeah, I think they're finding...
Not only meditation, just with awareness, if you see that pain is something purposeful, something positive, then you see this physical level is same pain. But mental attitude is something different.
I know.
Your Holiness, part of the complexity here is there are many aspects of the pain signal. There is no one pain signal. There's actually something called a pain matrix, and there are multiple pain signals that come together to produce the pain experience. So it's very difficult to generalize about a single pain signal.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to actually... This is a very important area of research for health and well-being, and it's important for contemplative studies as well. And it's becoming very well established. And for that reason, I'm actually going to move on to a more a mechanism that is less well understood, but I think is important for us, especially in understanding some of the dialogue between religion and science. So basically, there is another mechanism called the bodily self. And if I understood you correctly, I believe the bodily self represents the texture of one's inner experience. And we're getting some new research on the bodily self. Basically, what it involves is multiple brain maps, multiple body maps in the brain get unified together into a single higher order body representation. And that's the bodily self. All of those different maps come together. So, for example, if you hold your arm out and just imagine feeling the fingers, feeling the muscles, and looking at the arm, that is actually three different sensory streams. So, but we don't experience it as a fragmented three-part arm experience. We experience one unified arm. And Wolf Singer called this the binding problem. How does all of this different type of body experience get held together and form a unified percept?
And 원시의 초점 대백, 원시의 용어한테 그 초점 대백의 지기, 냠용지 자기를 달래 body self라고 그러지, body self. 근데 나온. 말다 라고 미게 통하다, 라베 레제 여보다, 라베 간다 지 디게디 요르데 이네 수수 라베 초의 기운들 걸 삼아서 초점 대백지 초범도 다대 다대지지.
And the reason why I'm telling you about this is because it turns out that the bodily self is a three-dimensional spatial experience.
So, for example, like when you touch the table with all your fingers, five fingers kind of spread out,
yeah.
You know, you do feel that there are individual sensations coming from the different fingers.
Yes.
You pay more attention here. There's something... Here, something different.
Yes, and that's the attentional spotlight of really focusing on a specific body area.
Did you temper table was? Did you never table in that? Because lotion parvana is chagoris.
You see, Kore,
Larin,
Yongda, Menemeda, yes,
Larin. But so, even at the level of the physical sensations, even at the level of physical sensation, without paying attention, there does seem to be. Distinct sensations coming from different fingers.
Yes, there are distinct sensations, but there's also this overall sense that we have of the body and space.
And it,
that overall sense also includes our sense of the internal texture of the body. And the only way that this can work is if all of these different body experiences of movement, muscles, touch, breathing, they all have to be held together. So,
with relation to body map you gave,
yeah.
I mean, is it the same area where the fingers are mapped versus toes?
Yes.
I mean, are they
so
differently?
Each one of those body maps actually is similarly organized. They're different body. There's many different body maps. So the first one that I showed you is just the most famous, but actually, it's a general principle of organization in the brain to have body maps that organize sensation and movement. So the real question, and this is the question that Wolf Singer asked. How is it that we have one unified experience of the body and not just a bunch of fragmented feelings? And that's this bodily self, the three-dimensional spatial experience of the body. And I'm going to just quickly tell you about a study called the rubber hand illusion, which we learned basically... We can trick you, Your Holiness, into thinking that your hand, that a doll's hand is part of your body. It's a science experiment. It's been done multiple times. And basically what is happening is the experiment plays with the streams that come together into the bodily self, and it changes them so that you're tricked into thinking that you have a body part that is not real. I don't know if that is worth... I have
Because rubber hand illusions. Here.
So if you watch, there's a film of the rubber hand illusion. Oh, sorry.
Judging by Solanus's reaction.
I can show this film.
This is uncontroversial, yeah? The rubber hand illusion phenomenon is uncontroversial.
So, yes, this has been replicated hundreds of times. And actually, I can generate the experience in 70% of people.
I think some occasion. I think mainly Japan, I think. Oh, I think even in India also, I think. You see the people, you see group of people, you see hand each other, you see touch. Mm-hmm. So some kind of energy, you see, goes hand to hand. Oh. Is it just superstition or some fact?
I don't know the answer to that question. but I actually have something relevant to say about it. And I think it relates to your question of inner texture, possibly. So I'm not going to go through the details of the rubber hand illusion, but I'm going to tell you that people who have different types of self structures, people who are very identified with the external experience of their body, have a stronger response to the illusion. So what this tells us is that self-processing, the sense of self, can shape your response to an illusion and actually can shape your own experience of body sensations.
So,
So I'm just going to tell you, I think, three more things, because I know time is short, but there is something called a whole body illusion, Your Holiness, that scientists in Europe are working with. And basically what this involves is through a trick. People are tricked. If you look at the volunteer, they stroke the mannequin and the man's body at the same time, and he's looking down his body. But they've tricked him because they put a mannequin there. So most people, when you look down your body, you expect to see your own body. For him, he sees a mannequin. And so what happens? They actually trick him so that his own corporeal awareness floats out of his own body and towards the mannequin. So his own sense of his own...
So just to be clear, so the process involves at one point the actual rubbing of the real body stops. Is that the idea? And then the rubbing.
So they're both rubbing at the same time.
Same time.
And what's happening is you're looking and watching the rubbing on the mannequin.
Yes.
And you start to think that that's your body. So corporeal awareness floats up into the fake body. Thomas Metzinger, the philosopher.
So there are in Indian Tibetan tradition ideas of transference of experience and other bodies. So maybe there is some.
I think that
there may be something to that.
And Thomas,
your sort of consciousness, you see, and that body,
So it's certainly an experiential process. And so I'm just going to mention one more thing, which is Thomas Metzinger, the philosopher, suggested that this might be a correlate of the subtle body.
Correlate of?
The Vajrayana subtle body. Subtle body.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm telling you this is because this is a different understanding of mind and body, and I was really struck by something that you said, Your Holiness, which is that within Vajrayana Buddhism, no absolute division can be made between mind and matter. And so this bodily self, which I think may represent that inner texture that you were talking about, it may represent a kind of intermediate state between mind and matter. And I guess my question is, I think that if we started to focus on this, there might be some resources for understanding healing and consciousness if we focus on this frontier mechanism. So I think that's all I have to say.
So this is at a very subtle level. Then there is no differentiation. I mean,
not talking about this body.
We're not talking about this gross, right, everyday body that made of flesh and bones.
Well, I wonder though.
I'm just curiosity. Mm-hmm. Do you ever sort of met someone, you see, who have the experience during dream time, you see, separate dream body develop and then go different places.
Different places.
I've definitely met people who have had that experience.
I met some European.
It could be a subtle body. So the bodily self is a novel area of scientific exploration, and it might help us understand some of these phenomena.
The bodily self said it.
And it could be helpful for understanding healing in different contexts.
Thank you very much.
I think we're going to now make a bit of a shift and invite Professor John Dunn to take the seat and to connect some of this to Dharmakirti's theory of concept formation. Thank you very much, Catherine.
Kathy, come this way.
So, Your Holiness, so far what we've been focusing on is actually perception.
Gunsum.
We had a talk on the Buddhist theory of Gunsum, about perception, by Jigishi Tumtun Jimbala. We heard from Bhavan Sinha about perception. And also this morning, Kathy's talk about bodily awareness was also meant to be focused on perception. Now we're going to try to make a shift, and we're going to start talking about concepts, or namtok.
Namtok,
tokma. Tokjaegullo. And in order to do that, my role is to present something about the Buddhist theory of concepts, which is known as the exclusion theory, or the apoha theory, or in Tibetan, the shensel theory of concept formation.
Shensel.
And of course, this puts me in a very embarrassing position because I have to talk to you about Buddhist philosophy. And if I were in the audience, I might be thinking to myself, "Ta inji yunten mebedi di shenzel kikola shena pendo karedo.
Iji yende meba chigi shense kol shena pendo karedo. Iji yende meba chigi shense kol shena pendo karedo.
So
he can do it himself. Yeah.
I said, "Who is this? Westerner with no good qualities? Why is he talking about our theory to us? About the theory of concept formation? It sounds better in Tibetan." So anyway,
I think through centuries in early period in this country, you see this concept is common, non-Buddhist and Buddhist. So that, for that, you see, I think through at least there's a few centuries, a lot of discussion. The concept, both have the common concept.
Concept, yeah.
But the definition, there's differences. So you see, through centuries, like Dignag and Dhammakirti and other sites, the non-Buddhist, I can't remember their name.
Kumari. Shunumalen Tatikitre.
Oh, Shunumalen.
Kumarila and Utyotekara.
So really, it's quite important. This has nothing to do with religion. Simply, you see, the explanation about
how thought.
The perception. Right? Perception. There are subtle differences. And topa sehati,
and how conceptual thoughts are in some sense much more selective and intelligent. It's more attention focused.
So I suppose
so therefore, you see, in the past, you see, no connection
with Tibetans.
In the West, in India, this is common. So congratulations, one Westerner who have no such idea now become something scholar. So congratulations.
Well, I will see how much of a scholar I really am. But I think one of the reasons that I'm presenting, though, Your Holiness, is it's not really for you. It is for the my fellow scientists here and colleagues. It is for the audience listening on the internet. And maybe also, because I'm going to focus on the Gyashung, the Indian texts, it might be somewhat interesting for the monastic audience as well. But of course, I'm sure most of them know much more about this than I do. So
that's very good. Actually, I always explain. All our knowledge here come from India. So therefore, I usually, you see, prefer ancient Indian psychology, Indian philosophical views, rather than Tibetan. So sometimes the people call Lamaism. That's supposed to be Tibetan's own creation. No. Kanyur Tenjul, about 300 volumes. That's our text. No. We learn from that. All these, including Buddha himself, is the most the Nalanda masters, their writing. So all our knowledge come from India. Very right.
So, Your Holiness, just to give you a quick outline of what I'm going to do today, I'm going to start with some sources, and then I'm going to talk about a model of perception and conceptuality of Ngunsum and Tokje Gilo. And then I'm going to ask, what is a concept? What do we mean by this idea of vikalpa in Sanskrit or namtok? Then I'm going to talk about the Buddhist approach specifically. And then I'm going to raise some key questions at the end. And I hope there will be time at the end. We started a little late today. Hopefully there'll be some time for us to discuss. But if not, we can continue in the afternoon, because part of what I'm trying to do is also set up Lera Boroditsky to, when she's going to talk more about concepts. And I think you'll find that there are going to be some interesting. So the sources that I'm drawing on are, of course, going to be similar to what Thutthin Jhimbala was talking about. But I'm going to focus on a particular series of Indian commentators who are from the very first Shakya Lodha. So all three of these, Your Holiness, so they say that Devendra Buddhi was actually, that Shlawang Lo was actually the student of Dharmakirti, and Shakyabuddhi was the student of Devendra Buddhi, And Janendra Buddhi was the student of Shakyabuddhi. And Devendra Buddhi and Shakyabuddhi both wrote commentaries on the Paramanavartika, on the Tsemanamdral of Dharmakirti. Janendra Buddhi wrote a commentary on Dignaga's text, the Paramana Samuchaya, the Tsemedo, but it's very heavily influenced by this style of commentary. So we can learn a lot about their first generation of interpretation by looking at these commentaries. And it also makes our task a little bit simpler. So let me now present to you a basic model of perception. So the basic idea here, we're going to look at this in greater depth soon, is that you have an external stimulus. So we're going to assume that there are objects, there is stuff outside of the mind. And that external stimulus somehow interacts with the sense organ, with the indriya or the wangpo, and it creates in the mind, which is on this side, so this is sort of representing in the mind, it creates an image in the mind.
Nampa.
Now, one of them, which is a nampa or a zungnam. Now, a couple of things I'd like to point out here. One of them is that this image, you'll see I've represented this with a different kind of color than this one. That's because this image is not exactly a reflection of the external matter. It goes through a causal process so that it is not simply exactly identical to the external matter. In fact, one of the best ways to talk about this is in terms of the terminology that is used by Dharmakirti himself and Dignaga, and it is to speak of this image as a zungnam, a grahyakara in Sanskrit, a phenomenal form of the object. So it's a kind of representation of the object. And at the same time, importantly, there's also a sense of there being someone who is a apprehender of that object, a dzinken, and that's called the dzinnam, right? And they arise simultaneously. That's called the phenomenal form of the subject. So these arise simultaneously. Now, it seems that for Dharmakirti, if we look around verses 98 to 100 of the Tsemanamdral of the Paramanavartika, and chapter 1 in the Rantun Jepak chapter, the chapter on inference, it seems that the way he wants to talk about concept formation focuses especially on the process of recognizing something when you perceive it. So here is time 1. At time 1, we're going to have three causal streams. We're going to have the causal stream of the object, the stuff out there. We're going to have the causal stream of the sense organ and the whole body, in fact. And we're also going to have the causal stream of consciousness itself. Now, right now, this is empty, but of course, consciousness is not empty in an ordinary person. There's desires, there's expectations, there are negative mental states, and so on. So this is happening at time. Now, what happens at time one is that this external object, again, this is an amplification of the previous slide, interacts with the sense organ to produce an image in the second moment that is an image of that object. Now, of course, also the sense faculty is continuing in time. This is the second moment. And the object... So one important thing that's very interesting about this theory of Dharmakirti is that this object that created is the cause, the mikyen, that is the cause of this image, the zungnam, has ceased to exist. It's gone. It only lasts for one moment. So what we have here in time two is not that object. We have the causal descendant, the effect of that object. So that's one important aspect of this. We are never actually apprehending objects. No. So maybe I will, His Holiness has just suggested that I amplify a little bit on this idea. So on this particular level of philosophy in Buddhism, the concept is that anything that exists causally exists only for one moment. So all things are what in Sanskrit is called kshanika, or kechigma in Tibetan, that is to say they are instantaneous or momentary. They never last more than one moment. So physical stuff, it looks like it's staying the same, but it's actually changing all the time. And mental stuff is also changing all the time.
But there is a continuum.
But there is a continuum, right? There's a continuum, and that's why it looks like it's the same.
You know, by the time the phenomenal form appears, the trigger is gone.
Yes,
the object,
right.
Yeah.
It's gone.
That imprint.
Yes. So that's a very interesting aspect of this theory, an important aspect. Now, in the third moment, or maybe it takes more than, maybe it takes a few more moments, but very quickly, we're going to have now the formation, and it's represented here by quotation marks. So this is going to be what in Sanskrit is called the Pratyaksha Prishtalabdha Nishchaya, or in Tibetan it's called the Ngunsumgi Jesu Drangbe Ngeshe. This conceptual determination, which we call in Western philosophy or perceptual judgment, that says this is blue.
So time three, we are already at the conceptual level.
Now we are, and that is exactly. So this, and I can even say that now. So this is what we call in Buddhist philosophy non-conceptual, tokme. But this is now already very quickly conceptual. And I'm going to talk now about what that means for it to be conceptual, but some things that you know, of course, Your Holiness, but I should clarify for our audience a couple of things. One of them is that when we say that this moment of perception is reliable, that it is a pramana or a tsema, according to these commentators, Lawang Lo and Shakya Lo, according to these commentators, this is a tsema because it can produce this ngeshe. It can produce this judgment. If it can't produce this, it's not a pramana. It's not a reliable cognition. It's only a reliable cognition if it produces this judgment. Secondly, this image can be reliable for some things and not for others. So, for example, if I take this glass, and obviously I am not an Arya, I am not a Pakpa. So if I'm an ordinary being, so if I look at this glass, it produces a zungnam, an image in my consciousness, and I can say it's a glass. So that zungnam, that image in consciousness, is a pramana, is a tsema for this being a glass. But I can't, just by looking at it, say it is momentary, that it's kechikma. Because this image in my consciousness cannot directly produce the judgment, the certain judgment, the ngeshe, that this is kechigma. Instead, I have to use an inference. I have to use jepak or anumana in order to do that. So the same image is a pramana for being a glass, but it's a tsema for it being a glass, but it's not a tsema, it's not reliable for it being kechigma. Right, so that's very important to understand that images are, we basically can have a very rich phenomenal world, and it can give us lots of information about our world, but it also at the same time can be unreliable about other aspects of our world. Now, one thing that's very important also for the Buddhist context is that even pigeons can use purung, can use concepts, right? And there are some, as Richie mentioned, there are some famous studies that were done at Harvard and elsewhere starting in the 60s that examine this fact. And of course, that makes sense from the Buddhist perspective. Of course, animals like pigeons definitely have conceptual cognition. But what is a concept exactly?
So they also have, because of they have the capacity for recognition and memory,
Yes.
So they're able to associate
exactly
what they see now with something they've experienced before.
And that's, yes, and that's going to be a very important aspect of what of how we understand concept formation. And another thing about this, maybe I will add while I'm here, we're going to talk more about it momentarily, is that when I don't, as Dharmakirti says, we don't make concepts for no reason. We do it because we are trying to engage in the world. We either want to get something or we want to avoid something. In Sanskrit, we speak of Heu Badeya, or in Tibetan, Langdor. But not in the sense of the path, of the spiritual path, but just what I want water. So that's something that I'm trying to get. That's my langja. I don't want pain. That would be a pangja. That would be something I'm trying to avoid. So it's only in that context that I use concepts according to Dharmakirti. And part of when we look at this model, what we can see is he's not really interested in higher order complex concepts. He's interested in very basic concept formation, the kind of concept formation that enables us to organize our perceptual world, what is occurring to us in our perception. So, what is a concept? Well, there's some one important the stream that, according to basically Dharmakirti and these commentators, when we say what we ask what a concept is, it is a cognition. It's a lo whose object form or zungnam can be mixed with language. So in Sanskrit, this is actually from the Nyaya Bindu. Right. Jibadandiruma, or Dradandiruma. Abhilapasam Sarga Yogya. So that means, and it's important to say that it can be mixed with language because even a child, even a baby, even an infant has concepts. And I'll say more about that in a minute. At a minimum, a concept involves repeatability. So this is actually a technical term originally coming from Sanskrit grammar. And in Tibetan, it translates as jesu drowa. So what it means is that So if I can borrow Jay's glass for a second. So when I'm identifying something, this as a glass, what I'm conceptually doing is I'm associating this with all other things that I call glasses. Specifically, as I will describe further soon, I'm associating it with the past experience of a glass, of something I call the glass. I see that, it activates that past experience, the imprint or the bakchak of that past experience, and I say, this is a glass, just like the past experience included a glass. So that activity means that what I'm doing is I'm seeing this as the same as that. This is the same as that, as same as that, same as that, same as that. So it seems that there's one thing occurring in many. This is a glass, this is a glass, this is a glass. They seem in my cognition to all be the same. So this is the concept of repeatability. In the Buddhist, as we will see, there's going to be a particular way of talking about repeatability in the Buddhist world. But I'm going to save that for a moment, and I want to just go to some confusions about concepts first before we look more at repeatability. And the confusion is that I think has already come up for us, is that in many scientific contexts, certainly in cognitive science, some people would even maintain that just edge detection constitutes a concept. Even edge detection is conceptual. And Your Holiness, edge detection is a very simple idea. If I have this book here, when that image projects into your consciousness, you are able to detect it without any kind of processing, without any kind of what Buddhists would call conceptual processing, you can pick it out from its environment. And Pavan was telling me, and maybe we'll talk more about this later, that this capacity occurs, even some aspects of this capacity occur with the blind children, the Prakash children, who are now able to see almost right away, actually. So edge detection is something, this capacity to pick out the object like that, is something that occurs at a very low level of perception. But edge detection is not Dadanjerung, it's not something that can be expressed in language. It's not got a linguistic structure. One interesting idea I'd like to raise for you, Your Holiness, is about what's one of the five omnipresent mental functions that occurs The Kundonga.
Yungenga.
Ah, Yungenga, Mare. Kundonga.
Kundonga, Kundonga, Dushe.
Yeah, and it's Dushe. That's right. And I would propose that we translate this as selection. It's defined as Nimitta Grahana, Tsemar Dzimba. But I think what it really means is picking out the object from the background in that way, just like edge detection. So I think when we think about sanjnya in the Buddhist context, mostly what we're probably doing is talking about, in the visual case, something like edge detection. That's an idea that I wonder what the scholars here would think. But even if that's the case, we know that sanjnya, that selection, has to occur even in non-conceptual cognition. But this idea of grasping the mark looks like it could be conceptual. That would mean we'd have a contradiction. So in order to So one way, so what we could say, Your Holiness, is that this edge detection, picking out the object from the background, does not involve jesudrowa, repeatability, and therefore it's not conceptual. So even if this is what sanjnya, what selection does, it would not count on the Buddhist world. In the Buddhist world, it would not count as conceptual cognition. But let's go back now and talk a little bit about what we mean about how these concepts are formed. So one account is what in cognitive science is often called the classical account. And I'm going to present the Indian version of this account, which is basically what you can call the realist account. It's the kind of account, it's what the Ngupurmawa, it's the kind of account you find in Kumarila, Shunumalen, in the Nyayikas, like Ujjotakara, in the Vaisheshika, and so on. And the first thing that we know, just by our own experience, is that when we think that this is also a pot, this involves repeatability. This is also a glass. Right? I'm recognizing it as the same as something I've experienced before. And the classical account explains this repeatability by asserting that a single entity, which in Sanskrit is called ghatatva, potness. So ghatta means pot. And this is
pumbani.
So everything that we call a pot has this potness. And I will show you a diagram that will help us to understand that. And this entity, such as potness, in Sanskrit is called a samanya or a chi. There are other words for it too. They're all translated in Tibetan by chi, but akriti, samanya, and jati all get translated by chi. But
sometimes we use rik. Yeah. Rik also.
Oh, rik, jati. But I think jati. Not in this context.
Okay.
And the individuals are called particular swalakshana, or actually there's another word that is also used, which is vyakti, and that in Tibetan is selva. So let me show you now. This will help us, I think, understand this. So the idea is this, basically. Along the bottom are a bunch of individuals, individual things. These are all rangsen or selva. And the idea on this theory is that there's some kind of a universal, a chi, called potness that is somehow present in all of these individuals. So that when we see that this is a glass, we think that this is a glass, and this is a glass, and this is a glass, because there's some kind of glassness that is present in all of them. That's why we can recognize them all as glasses. So I think that's probably pretty clear. Now, as it turns out, well, maybe I may quickly note, there's a tendency in some aspects of Western philosophy that are Platonic in flavor to think that this is the truly real thing, and in some ways these are a reflection of that. But in Buddhism, we flip this on its head. This is actually going to turn out to be unreal. The real thing is just the particulars that actually have causal function. Now, the Buddhist account is going to disagree with this idea. It's going to disagree with the idea that there's one potness in every pot, or a glassness in every glass. This is the idea of the separate universal, the chi tunshen, or the chi yanggarwa. They say that kind of universal does not exist, this entity that's in the world. And it doesn't exist because it doesn't stand up to a particular kind of analysis called the one nor many analysis. Instead, all things are actually unique. Every glass is actually unique, subtly different, sometimes very obviously different. These chairs, we call these things all chairs, but they are noticeably different, right? So each of these things is actually unique. No two things are, in fact, identical. In order to say that two things are each a pot, therefore, or a glass, you have to make up a kind of potness. You have to create a universal for them. And that pot universal then seems to be something that they all share. So the Buddhist process of doing this is called the apoha theory, shensel. So there is no real potness, there's no real glassness out there. Instead, we're going to create, we're going to use our mind unconsciously to create something that is the same about all glasses. So let me talk about some key features of this theory. The sameness, right? The fact that this is a glass and this is a glass, they are same. That sameness, which is constructed through exclusion, consists in a non-different difference. Now, this is a phrase that will be new to many of the scholars here. This is actually coming from the Rangdrel, the Swavritti of Dharmakirti, the auto commentary on the inference chapter. And it's a particular kind of interesting way of trying to talk about this, and I'm going to explain it. But basically, the main point here for the moment is what's important is that the way in which we're going to talk, we're going to make these the same, is that we're going to focus on their causal characteristics. What can they do causally? So that's the paradigmatic case, the way in which a universal is going to be constructed. And I'll talk more about that soon. However, as it turns out, when we do this, because these two things are actually different. Oh,
non-difference la tu gala kan sewa chrawa pumbe sewa thade ba dikida nam pe tu dewa zan yo ma re de ta te tam je le pumbo nyam be lo chi jebu chung ba yin za sta
o de
jebu chung be to ne thade yo ba de che tu tok be ta me de ba so ne chi bu da bu nang ju je ta di de he de ba kan de chi tun shen yo ma re se chi tun shen yo ma re de ta yin ne
So, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that, Your Holiness, and please correct me if I make any mistakes. Now, as it turns out, this kind of a cognition is what we call a conceptual cognition. We're going to form this concept through the process of exclusion, and as it turns, it is always distorted. It's always a truché. It always involves a distortion, but it can lead to successful action in a way that I will explain. And as we will find out, as I already mentioned, and we'll talk a little bit more about, this process of forming concepts through exclusion always involves goals. It's always oriented toward trying to get something or avoid something. Basically, it's in the context of what you might call approach avoidance. Now, this is a citation from the Rangdrel, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to actually go through the details of this citation, but in the Tibetan, it mentions that it's in the Tibetan slide, it mentions... So the basic point of this, what this is saying is that when we, that things actually are all unique, and this is, he says literally, well, then we'll go ahead through the English translation. It's already been shown that things are not mixed in their natures. In this regard, a cognition in which they appear to be mixed is distorted, and I'm going to explain how it's distorted. But it has also been shown that those different things, acting as the cause of a concept, produce that cognition through a process naturally. So even though they are different, because of their causal characteristics, they can be they can create a concept of them as the same. And this is called their non-different difference, because those different things produce some single effect, such as a cognition.
Can you go back to the Tibetan?
Yeah.
And the non-different difference. Didagi, tadebatene, tamedebashin. Nos, tanatante, tadun, tabeliuk. So it's also in Kamalashila's commentary on the Shapta Artha.
Yeah, Dratun Thakpa. Exactly. Yes, it is. That's right, Your Holiness. And he actually.
No.
Do you
want to say that?
You go ahead.
Okay. This kind of differentiation of what is essentially non-different also arises in the context of, you know, when you propose a form of argument, say a pot is impermanent because it is a product causally produced. So the property of being causally produced and property of being impermanent are essentially the same thing, but conceptually they are distinct, and therefore we can use one attribute as a reason to prove the other. But in reality, there is no differentiation between, because there is only one thing, which is the pot.
In other words, another way of saying this is this: part of what this theory helps to do is it tells us the way in which we can abstract qualities from the glass. We can say the glass is impermanent. We can say the glass is fragile, without saying that the impermanence is a separate real thing, which would turn it into this kind of universal. So we can abstract all kinds of qualities from it without multiplying entities in the universe, basically. So let me talk a little more practically about, now we sort of had a little dive into the text, and I encourage anyone who's interested to look at that passage in the Svavritti. It's very in the Rangdrel. It's a very interesting passage on verse 109 of the Rantun Jepak chapter. So let me talk now a little bit in more practical terms about how does this work? How do we do this construction of the glasses being the same or pots being the same? So first we know everything is actually different from everything else. I think His Holiness already referred to that famous verse which starts, yes, yeah. So, sarve bhava swa bhavena swa bhava vyavastitehi. And so that everything is unique. But when we consider some things to be the same, we're actually going to ignore the ways in which they are different from each other. So these two glasses, let's do these two chairs. If I call these two things chairs, they're quite different. This looks very different than this. But when I call it a chair conceptually, I ignore the ways in which they're different, and I'm going to focus on the way in which I can make them the same. So how do I do that? What we're going to focus on is their difference from everything else. Different, and how are they different from everything else? They're different from things that do not perform the desired function. What in Sanskrit would be called the ishtartha, the desired goal. We can't achieve our goal. If I want to sit down, I can't use a glass. If I want to drink water, I can't use a chair. So these two things are, I'm going to call them the same, even though they're different. I'm going to make them the same because this is different from things that do not perform the function of chairs. This is different from other things that do not perform the function of chairs. So because this is different from those, this is different from those, I say they're the same because they have the same difference. So I'm not constructing a positive universal. I'm actually constructing their sameness by excluding other things, by their differentiation from other things. So what that enables me to do is to ignore how they're different and focus on their causal sameness. Now, this difference... Yes?
Here. Okay.
So
the way that they're different from other things, as you expressed it, is they afford sitting, right? That they serve yes. the function of sitting. But there are lots of things that you can sit on, right? So you can sit on a table, you right. can sit on the floor, you can sit on an elephant or on a bicycle, just about any flat surface.
And it's a bit louder, I am.
Louder.
You can sit on just about any flat surface, right? On a donkey, on a... I can list lots and lots of flat surfaces.
Yes.
How do you deal with that problem of over-inclusion?
Overextension, yes. Well, they don't really seem to there. I think in the end, this is a little... This would not be a standard view. So I'm sure that I will be critiqued for saying this. But I do not think that these categories are meant to have hard edges. I think that this way of talking about categorization is meant to be fuzzy. Except when you're dealing with concepts that are analytically related to each other. And that's very important. Analytically related concepts are definitional. So if I have a definitional concept of a chair, it's going to, for example, if I say a chair necessarily has a back, then I can't call anything that doesn't have a back a chair. So I can take these low-level concepts and interpret them in a way that makes them analytically related to each other. And in that case, then, we have sort of a definitional case of concepts with boundaries. But at the level of interpretation of perception, it seems to me that Dharmakirti is not really interested in making those kinds of firm boundaries yeah. of categories. He's interested in firm boundaries for qualities of things, because they end up being analytically related to each other. I don't know if that makes sense, but maybe we'll go on. We'll talk yeah. more this afternoon.
All right. Yeah.
So the upshot is that the difference, what we end up then is the chairs are all different from things that don't perform the function of chair.
So the question you are raising is that in that case, mind can make up any categories. Is that the question you are asking?
Yes.
So in fact, this raises an important point. Even within the Buddhist world, this kind of Dharmakirtian approach has been critiqued because it presupposes a real world and its dichotomy from something that is constructed.
It means something independent, absolute.
Yes, yes.
Now that Madhyamaka philosophy say no.
Yeah.
So mere designation. Santa Tanya to Chava, tell Tanya with something, many of the Yavas of Shaman. And talk about Council Soy Maris.
So the Madhyamikas have a much more pragmatic criteria of what constitutes something as real, which is it takes into account the shared convention of the world, and also the functions these objects perform, so that it's not everything goes, not anything goes. There is a kind of a boundary, but at the same time, it does not insist on there being something real out there that the terms refer to. So it's a complex question.
I'm almost done here, yeah. So can we yeah, hold
I think,
it?
Let's
let a couple of interventions. Yes.
It's a continuation of that point. In a sense, what you seem to be saying is that not only are the boundaries fuzzy,
yes.
but that it allows the boundaries to be fluid, to change
well,
with the next experience and the next experience. And that's wonderful, but in contrast, the analytical level sounds very reified. As soon as you put a boundary around it, it's fixed, and therefore it's negative. Does that make sense?
I think that makes some sense, and actually as it turns out, the purpose of placing boundary around, this is going to involve a kind of reasoning, which is called by reasoning by way of the essential qualities of things, or svabhavahetu, or ranjangita yandak in Tibetan. Basically, what it means is you're trying to explore the meaning of your own concepts. So it turns out that the concept of being causally produced, there's a single word for that in Sanskrit, kurtaka. So So the concept of being jepa, or causally produced, necessarily implies the concept of being momentary. But we don't know that. When we apply the concept causally produced, I know that somebody made this. I don't think this is eternal. But I don't know my ordinary state, that concept also means that I have to call this momentary.
But then why?
So the way you do that is you start to analyze how those concepts are working. What does it really mean for something to be causally produced? What is causality? And so that's where you're getting into a kind of deeper philosophical analysis, which emerges out of this first level of presentation. Remember, this is really about perception and how you organize your perceptual experience.
Geshe-la. Yes.
Gisela is asking John to show the quotation that he Gisela is commenting on the quotation that that John has brought up here. In the first line, the reference is to the explanation about perception, saying that now I have finished explaining about perception, now I'm moving on to conceptual thought. The reference to difference is that they are empirically different, that they do not mix up spatially, temporally, even entity-wise also. But when conceptual thoughts relate to them, then they relate to them by association of what the person had experienced before, and thus resort to a kind of collation, a kind of a mechanism of collating them, spatially, temporally, and even entity-wise, to then accomplish a particular action. So the reference to the difference is that things are individually different, and the reference to the non-difference is the action of the conceptual thought, in that the conceptual thought resorts to non-differentiating between them by imposing some kind of commonality between them, and through that then engages in some kind.
So I have a couple of really important things, but it won't take long. So the main point here, now I said also that conceptuality is distorted. How is it distorted? It's distorted, or truṣe, it's tropa, or bhranta in Sanskrit, and because of two togma mebe bhakchak, anadivasana, two beginningless imprints. They're beginningless in the sense they have to be built into the system. You have to be born with them. The first is that the phenomenal content in a conceptual cognition is fused. The term here in Sanskrit is eki karana. It means chiktu jepa.
Chiktu jepa.
It's fused with an object in the world. So when I think of a glass, I think that the glass I'm thinking of is a glass in the world. If I think of the Eiffel Tower, I think that the Eiffel Tower, the image of the Eiffel Tower in my mind is the Eiffel Tower. I don't mistake. In other words, I take it and I project it into the world. And the second thing that I'm doing is, even though this thing is unique, and also my moment of cognition is unique, I'm thinking that it's the same as something else. So that's also something I can't learn. Because there are no two things in the world that are the same. So that has to be built into my system. The capacity to make things the same has to be something that's supplied from my cognitive system. It can't be coming from things in the world. So if we represent that in terms of...
So you're not talking about two imprints. You're talking about two ways in which the beginningless imprints affect.
No, there actually he identifies this as anadi vasana, as toma maybe bachak in the
Rondo. But there are no two imprints.
Yeah, maybe it's true. It's probably, I think you're right, Your Holiness. It's probably really one imprint with two effects. It's marikba. It's ignorance. He says, Nam tokni. It's probably better not to say two imprints. I agree. Because in the end, Your Holiness, he says in the Rangra, it's very interesting. He says, Nam tokni marikbao. In other words, that conceptuality is the expression of ignorance. And so if we think of these two, the ways in which our experience is confused, one of them is that this is the conceptual cognition, where now we're thinking blue. And we're thinking that this, what's in our consciousness, is actually out there in the world. And then the second thing is that we associate this idea of blue with previous experiences of blue. And we think they're the same, but they're not, right? Now, last thing that's quite important, I think, is the context of action. We're at 11:26 right now, and hopefully we'll have some time for a little discussion. But we may have to discuss in the afternoon. So in order to act on objects, according to Dharmakirti, and especially Shakyabuddhi and Devendrabuddhi, we have to conceptualize them. In other words, if we go back here, if I don't think this is a glass, if I don't get to this point, I just have this, that's called nanla mangepa. It's an appearance without a determination. So in order for me to reach out and get the glass, I have to have a conceptualization, right? So that's the first thing. We must conceptualize objects to act on them. Actions occur in the context of obtaining the desirable and avoiding the undesirable. And this, interestingly, may be culturally dependent. So if I was born in New York and I didn't remember anything from my former life. So I didn't have the goal when I was born in New York. I never would have the goal of becoming a Buddhist monk. It was only when I contacted another culture that could become a goal for me. And that I could even have concepts around that goal.
As far as memory, what past life is concerned, actually I met two Indian girls, one at Kampur when I met, 4 years old. The parent, no concept of previous life. But that young girl very clearly expressed the memory of past life. So eventually that 4-year-old girl, 4 parents, the previous sort of life also 1 girl, and at a very young age, Hazrat passed away. So still, the previous life's parent is still there. So she clearly recognized, this is my parent. And their name, and their house. So the previous life's two parents also, you see, accept that girl is their daughter. So this life's two parents. So fortunate maybe, more parent is very good. So we always say, entire sentient being our mother. Mm-hmm. So at least you see that young girl, two mothers.
So
the family, not sort of that kind of sort of the
cultural.
Of course, as Indian, maybe This is generally believe, you see, the previous life or next life. But then, one American scientist, you see, they carry particular sort of research work about the reincarnation. So I think in...
Ian Stevenson at University of Virginia.
Lebanon.
Druze.
Yeah. You see, but there are many Muslims, you see, and also Christian, you see, no concept of previous life. Of course, this very life created by God directly. Of course, next life, you see, there are. So you see, there are, I think, a few hundred children who clearly mentioned about their past
previous life. Previous
life. Like that. So that's it, but culture in a manner.
So Solness's point is to what extent they're actually culturally conditioned.
Right. So clearly it seems Your Holiness
argue the opposite, that if something like that phenomenon happens in a cultural environment where these are not part of the cultural beliefs, you can take them more seriously. Whereas in a cultural environment, these things are taken for granted. Then when people make claims, you can take it with more skepticism.
I certainly don't mean to suggest, Your Holiness, that all concepts are culturally conditioned in the same way. But I think some concepts are. And I think another thing that's interesting about concepts is that they are related to each other. So I might believe, for example, if someone is named Jimpa, then he must be nice. But there may be some Jimpas out there who are not. Jimpa, you know?
Samzulia, miti mingle Jimpa si na, ku miti sangbu yu shashar, chikchin tinte kyaba yu bong, nisya churwas.
Right? Or I can have racist views if some...
Genre. So one could say that someone who's called John is necessarily a little shrewd.
And of course we know this in the context of racism, so that we can believe if someone is of a particular race, then that they are a thief or that they are dangerous or whatever it might be. So we have these concepts that are learned concepts that are often wrong. And of course, we use reason to correct our incorrect conceptual relations. And then finally, the one thing I just want to mention briefly is the idea, and let me just do this by talking about the example. Dharmakirti mentions this example. Traditionally in India, if you were from a Brahmin family, your first teacher of Sanskrit was your father. He would be your first teacher of Sanskrit. So he says, when you see him coming, you don't say, "Oh, there's my teacher." You say, "There's my father." You could use either concept, but you say, "There's my father," because there's a kind of association, an emotional association with that concept. And that makes that concept seem more important than the other one. So that's a very important issue. And this then leads us to our questions that we'll end with. One of them is, basically, the main point here is that our behavior is driven by our conceptual judgments following non-conceptual perception. That's the Buddhist theory. And the Tibetan here is available. So... the same
silence lab de de nyong tso to ne ke chi jong de du no nyong tso to ne ke chi jong sa de du den de yebe.
So a very interesting question is, maybe we can change these things through training. If I have the goal of becoming rich, what happens to my conceptual life when my goal changes to becoming happy? If I have certain kinds of concepts that create very strong emotional reaction in me, what happens if I learn to regulate those emotions? Does my way of thinking actually change? Can I become habituated to certain kinds of concepts? And what if my idea of the world changes? My whole jikdengi namshak, my sense of the cosmos changes. Does that actually change the way in which I use concepts? Does that change the way I think, possibly? So these are interesting questions. Some of them will come up, I think, this afternoon. Some of them are also about meditation and contemplative practice. But that's it. We're out of time. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much, Your Holiness.
So the point His Holiness is making is that to add and reinforce that even the knowledge that are coming through inference are ultimately grounded in some form of perception.
Exactly.
Because, there's the...
Right.
Experience. Yes. And the analogy used is that a blind, finally being led by someone who's sighted. So perception is the sight, and the inference is the blind.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you, Your Holiness. Thank you, Catherine. We're now going to take a break and reconvene at 1 o'clock. Professor Lara Boroditsky will be following up on this very directly by talking about the impact of language on concepts, language on our conceptual life. That session will go until 3 o'clock, and from 3:30 to 4:30, there will be a question and answer session. And participants both here at Lachi and at remote locations are encouraged to write your questions and to put them in the question boxes that are available so that those can be posed to all of the speakers this afternoon.
But they will also be handheld mics.
Yes, and there will be microphones available for people to ask their questions. We also encourage everybody to visit the Sarah J. Science Center and to visit the secondary school, where there's a lot to see about how science education is happening in the monasteries. Thank you all, and we will see you back here at 1 o'clock. Thank you.